Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Let's talk with Anna Glavinsky.
We're going to be talking about the story of the British sailor who invented the modern drug trade. So it all just sounds very... what's that? Oh, I've just thought of a pirate word. Swishbuckling. It sounds very swishbuckling. Really looking forward to it. David, good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning. It's great to be here. I'm doing very well. How are you, Anna?
Yeah, really good. Really looking forward to hearing more about your story. What inspired you to decide to go into this particular story yourself?
Yeah, so I was doing some family research and exchanging notes with a distant cousin who said almost, you know, off the cuff, oh, by the way, you should look into our mutual cousin. He ran guns and drugs and worked with Cuban intelligence and was assassinated in Miami. And it was one of those stories that you couldn't turn away from, but did a little bit of digging. And I spoke with another family member and she said, oh, yeah, he used to run drugs for Castro. And with that, I was completely hooked. And from there, I spent the past year and a half just chronicling this amazing, amazing life. And you started off by saying intense, hardcore swashbuckling, and I think that captures it.
So it's actually a family member. Do you feel connected to Harold Durber? Do you feel connected to him because you have that family connection? And,
yeah,
and how
absolutely.
Do you feel about also that, you know, it's quite shady, this story, quite, very. Is it something you want to be shouting about? Hey, this is in my genes.
Yeah, so I always knew that the British side of my family had some shady characters, but it was only when I really dug into his story that I realized exactly how shady it was. And unfortunately, I never got the chance to meet him. We'll get into the fact that he was assassinated in 76 when I was just a small child. But the more I learned about him and his upbringing, growing up in Manchester during the Blitz and then serving the Battle of the Atlantic and having just this unbelievable life, I definitely felt like I grew closer to him over time.
I mean, it sounds fascinating. Tell us a little bit about that story, a bit of a synopsis, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. So the big question is, how does a Jewish kid from Manchester growing up during the war end up becoming the largest marijuana trafficker in American history? So he grew up in Manchester during World War II, survived the Manchester Blitz evacuation. And I think Manchester in particular was a pretty rough place to grow up during the war, because not only because of rationing and the evacuation, but you also had the black shirts around the corner. Not a lot of people know that there are actually Jewish detention camps in England. So about 8,000 Jews were detained in camps in England because they were nominally Austro-Hungarian or German. And then so they got caught up in the whole detention program. So although he was never detained, his family members had to go before the internment tribunals. And then at 16, to escape it all, he signs up with the British Merchant Navy. And at 17, he joins the Dutch Merchant Navy fleet and sails off to fight in the Battle of the Atlantic as a radio operator. And you can also imagine what it must have been like as not only the only non-Dutchman, but a 17-year-old British Jewish kid on a boat full of very salty Dutch sailors fighting on the Battle of the Atlantic. And the Merchant Navy ships were just absolutely wretched. I mean, if you think about the worst seedy dive bar you've ever been in, except now it's floating in the Atlantic and you're being shot at by torpedoes. So he serves in the Battle of the Atlantic. And then afterwards, he engages in a lot of Cold War smuggling, smuggling contraband oil into the Soviet bloc, fights a little bit in the Israeli War of Independence to smuggle illegal arms into Israel during that conflict. And that was kind of a interesting scenario because you know that the British Royal Navy was manning the blockade. And a lot of the volunteers in the Israeli Navy were actually British Merchant Navy sailors. So you have this weird situation where you have Merchant Navy sailors trying to run the blockade of Royal Navy sailors that they were just fighting, you know, shoulder to shoulder with just a few years ago. He does like a career sampling of different types of criminal activity at this stage. He does a little bit of corporate espionage, some stock fraud. One little interesting tidbit is that he produced Francis Ford Coppola's first two films when Coppola was still a film student. Eventually makes it down to Miami, where he joins up with the Miami Mafia and the Cuban refugee movement. He runs a private ferry between Cuba and the U.S. He had the exclusive contract to provide private transportation out of Cuba. It was an agreement that he struck up with Fidel Castro and Cuban intelligence. And the Kennedy government came smashing down on him pretty hard. So they sent CIA and state officials after him, and they basically aggravated them and chased him all over the Caribbean. He eventually does a trial run, bringing 2 dozen Cubans to America, and is deported as a national security risk, makes it back to England. And then he does some financial fraud in Canada before settling down in Latin America. At this stage, he's surviving off of boat hijackings and bank fraud. And then something very peculiar happens. In 1970, the Nixon administration signs the Controlled Substances Act, but they made a big, big mistake, which is that they accidentally created this legal loophole called the mothership loophole, which made it legal accidentally to have drugs on high seas. So overnight, it became perfectly legal to have drugs in international waters. And my cousin Harold Derber realized that this was the smuggling opportunity of a lifetime. So he pioneered the mothership technique of drug smuggling, where he would take a large cargo freighter, fill it with 50 tons of weed, and then have speedboats race out of Miami and do the drug transfers mid-ocean. So if you think of Miami Vice and the powerboats sort of racing out of Miami Beach. So that was very much to do the offloads with the motherships that were parked out in international waters. And by doing that, he became the largest marijuana smuggler in American history at the time, moving somewhere between 500 to 2,000 tons of marijuana per year. Eventually, he gets tied up with Cuban intelligence, and he picks up the guns for drugs trade. So while he drops off the weed, he's then on the return trip, bringing guns to armed Marxist guerrillas throughout Latin America. He engages in a massive stock fraud to launder his weed money. And then eventually he's shot down by a professional hitman in 76. So that's the that's the amazing story. And it just boggles the mind how he managed to be at every major flashpoint, and how this, you know, good-mannered Jewish kid from Manchester grows up to be one of the largest drug traffickers America's ever seen.
And what factors do you think turned him into that person? Because the way you tell the story, it's almost just as if it was a career path, like started off as a receptionist, then joined the junior ranks in the sales team, and then got taught some techniques and ended up, you know, CEO of the company or whatever. But purely by doing illegal, shady, bad stuff, so what do you think are the factors that took him down that path? Because there wasn't a path ahead of him that he could follow step by step. He was pioneering. He was leading the way. Do you think it was just his character and his looking for opportunities? Or do you think he was so embedded in that world, there was no other alternative for him? It was that way or nothing.
Yeah, I think a lot of it was survival. So in many cases, you know, he was scrapping by as a Merchant Navy sailor. And when the exchequer depegged the pound from the dollar in 49, it hit the Merchant Navy sailors particularly hard because they received their salary in pounds, but then their expenses were in foreign currencies. So basically they had their paycheck cut by 40%. So a lot of Merchant Navy sailors, such as Harold, turned to contraband smuggling. not to over-psychologize it, but I do have to wonder if his upbringing during what was just a really wretched time in Manchester had to have played a role. So between the Blitz, the black shirts, evacuation, detention camps, growing up in poverty, and then at 17 years old, you find yourself on a Dutch and then a Norwegian merchant ship, you know, in the middle of the Atlantic. I do wonder if part of that experience set him on a lifetime of not only criminality, but also adventure seeking, because ultimately, I think he was a lover of danger and adventure. And so part of it was a lust for cash and for, you know, foiling the law. But I think also he was a man of adventure, and he found himself at, you know, the world's major conflicts, going from World War II through the Bay of Pigs to the Cuban Revolution to the rise of the Latin American guns for drug trade. So I think it was probably a combination of circumstances forcing him down that path. But also, I do wonder if, you know, suffering through that war trauma might have prompted him to sort of revisit that, you know, through his later exploits.
And I'd like to ask about violence as well, because the drug trade is known for that. He was clearly no stranger to it, having been, you know, you say he's in this ship with all these sort of unsavory characters. Plus, he's getting thrown into battle after battle. You know, he's been through war. So violence must be part of his makeup. It's part of his story. Was it, do you think there was no way that he could have gone into a career or built this trade without violence, or did he more go towards sort of intelligence and just smartly finding loopholes? And
yeah, it's really interesting. So he had a certain code of honor where he never engaged in violence himself. So it's very interesting because, you know, in the States, we tend to have two stories about the rise of the drug culture. We have like the 1960s counterculture, and then you flash forward to the Medellin cartel and Pablo Escobar and this ultra-violent organized crime. But there was actually a generation of smugglers that got us from point A to point B, which were the so-called gentleman smugglers. So these were largely fishermen, returning Vietnam vets, in the case of Harold Durber, a British merchant Navy sailor, that helped provide the supply for America's growing demand for marijuana. And it's exactly during that period between the 1960s and the mid-1970s where you see a tripling of marijuana use in America. And a lot of that was made possible by the transportation infrastructure that my cousin created with the mothership technique. So although he himself was never engaged in any violence, ultimately, he did meet a very violent end at the hand of professional assassins. And so part of it is also the transition into that violent period of the drug trade when the Colombians begin to get involved and the Medellin cartel takes off. But he himself, besides being a major arms smuggler, as far as I can tell, never, you know, ordered a hit on anyone or was, you know, committing violence himself.
Okay. And I mean, there's a huge attention to detail in everything that you're talking about as well. How did you do your research and discover so much information about this one guy?
Yeah, so I was really fortunate because I was able to track down some of his former drug trafficking associates who are now in their 70s and 80s. And, you know, a few of them said, oh, well, you know, I can't tell you anything because people have long memories and they might come after me. Ah, what the hell, I'll tell you anyways. So they provided a lot of color. I was able to track down the son and grandchildren of his lover, who was a CIA contractor, and got access to her memoirs. And she herself is an amazing, amazing woman. And I hope someone writes her story one day. Her name was Sari Leslie or Sari Cohen. And there was a very interesting Mr. and Mrs. Smith situation where she was a contractor to the CIA and he was working with Cuban intelligence at the same time. So they were sort of dancing around each other. So that memoir was really helpful. And then he shows up in roughly three dozen archives, both in US, UK, Colombia, Mexico, Tel Aviv. So I was helped by a really, really dedicated team of historians who were able to access a lot of the archival material. But he has a number of dedicated files at the National Archives in the UK, likewise in the US. And then I was also helped by roughly a dozen or so Freedom of Information requests. So I was able to obtain his immigration file, which is 2,500 pages long, his FBI file. Interestingly, when I did the Freedom of Information request to the Drug Enforcement Administration, they said they couldn't disclose his file because it would reveal their methods and sources. And so I appealed that decision, saying it was 50 years ago and what possible methods could, you know, be compromised at this stage. And then he replied saying, well, actually, we destroyed all his files.
Ooh,
so,
wow.
So there you go. And his NSA file, the National Security Agency file, is still classified. And I'm preparing a lawsuit now to take him to court to open up his file.
Wow. What a mad story. Are you going to go to approach Netflix with this?
We have been approached by a few streaming platforms. Yeah. So that's very much my passion. If I can get it made into a streaming show, that would be an absolute delight because, you know, it's got everything. It's got guns, drugs, lover in the CIA, Fidel Castro, you know, what's there not to love?
But well, that leads me to sort of my final question, which is about legacy, but also about, I don't know, I suppose a moral standpoint. This guy is a member of your family. His legacy lives on in the drugs trade, which isn't necessarily the most savory trade. Marijuana is legal in so many places now. So I think, you know, the actual drug itself is being recognized perhaps as maybe a little bit more innocent in terms of other hard drugs. But the world around it isn't so innocent, especially in the places where it's still illegal. Do you feel a pride in thinking, you know, in being related to this guy, or do you feel perhaps around that question?
Yeah, I think it's an important question, and I tried really hard not to glorify his life, even though he lived a very romantic life, and it was a life of adventure and international intrigue. I didn't want to glorify or romanticize it in any way, because even though we have a very much more tolerant attitude towards marijuana use now, at the time it was very much an illicit drug. And as I get into in the book, it helped finance a lot of the Latin American revolutionaries in Colombia and Nicaragua and Honduras. So even though we think of it as a very innocuous drug, it's caught up in the nexus of organized crime that funds a lot of other unsavory activities. So I do present that moral choice for the readers. So I present the facts as they are, and they're completely unglorified, unvarnished truth. And then the readers can decide, okay, is this, a moral crusader, freedom fighter, who happened to pioneer the drug trade? Or is this an unsavory con man that, you know, ultimately not what was coming to him, but I'll leave that decision to my readers.
Well, I'm really glad thank you for giving so much thought into answering that question. Like I said, I do think it is an important one, but the book itself sounds incredibly exciting. What's next for you? Is television, looking forward more to that, or have you got another story up your sleeve?
So I'm in the UK now doing the book tour. So we have appearances at Waterstones, the Imperial War Museum, and the East India Club. And then the book will be released in the US in late October. So we'll be doing the US tour. And so very much looking forward to telling the story and meeting my readers. I love nothing more than meeting my readers and getting to share the story with them firsthand. And then I have two other books that I'm working on. One is a overlooked story of World War II espionage. And then another one is a biography of an American psychiatrist who fought the intelligence agencies and the psychiatric establishment to get recognition for PTSD during the Vietnam War. So two other books in the works. If you'll have me, I'll look forward to sharing that story with your listeners sometime when those come out in the future.
We would love to speak to you again. They both sound absolutely fascinating. Not so much light bedtime reading. You really like to go for the hard-hitting stuff, don't you?
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but I'm just drawn to true crime, espionage, and where they overlap. I think that's really fascinating, sort of the nexus of intelligence cooperation with organized crime, I think, is just a fascinating topic. And, you know, in the case of Durber, he had probably about a dozen government agencies and just as many criminal factions all descending on him. And they're all sort of coordinated and working to capture his mothership fleet. So it's a good example too of how, you know, these various, parties can have, you know, overlapping interests in order to get what they want.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, we'll leave it there for this morning. David, thank you so much for joining us today. Have a lovely day. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Anna. It's been a pleasure. Take care.
So that was David Tuck, spelled T-U-C-H. And the book is called The Wireless Operator, The Untold Story of the British Sailor Who Invented the Modern Drug Trade. You can find it on Amazon, pop it into Google, or of course, go find it on the Talk Radio Europe bookshop.